It's that time of the day again when you get your daily dose of the Rugby World Cup, courtesy of News24's daily and dedicated podcast to the Springboks title defence, The Inside Pass. As was the case yesterday, I'm joined by our man in France, senior sports writer Kanyiso Chwako, and today we're actually going to try to discuss this minor insinuation that the Boks are manipulating the HIA laws to basically get rolling substitute or a rolling substitution system sort of going. Trucks, are you with me just yet?
Yes, I am.
Listen, we've obviously outlined the basic sort of parts of our discussion. What have you got going today in terms of the Boks? I think we've now officially, you know, gotten rid of the match from last from Sunday. But what we really are now, probably the area we're probably just crossing, is that one where we're starting to wonder about the team announcement. How's that looking?
Well, the long and the short of it is that the Boks have moved back up north. They've up sticks to Le Domaine. That particular hotel I complained about early on when they were playing Ireland. So they've moved back up there. They are training at the Stade de Fauvet, which is about a 20-minute drive from that particular hotel. So they've got training at 3 o'clock today. And then there's a press briefing at 5:30. So from here, the South African press corps will have to up sticks and go to Stade de Fauvet. We have to catch a train at Gare du Nord. We get off at Domon Station and we'll walk 15 minutes to the ground to watch that particular 15-minute session of training, get back on the train, go to Courcelles, which is 2 stations up, and then walk to the hall. Fortunately, they're not having the press conference at the hotel. They're having it at a hall inside the city, which is a bit more, which is a bit better for us in some ways, but it's still a bit of a trek. Last week, they were in the west of Paris, across the River Seine. So the Boks are very intent on moving us, like they did the French pack in the scrum on Saturday around Paris.
Well, as long as nobody calls a scrum on a mark, I think you guys are basically okay. Trucks, let's start with one of the things. I know I said, you know, we've kind of shed the Sunday's game, but obviously one of the themes that are coming out, particularly from England, one of the themes that are coming out of that, you know, there's an implication, and it's not implicit, but it's definitely there that the Boks are using the HIA protocols to basically try and sort of get a sense of rolling subs. And obviously, I mean, looking at Sunday's game, given the intensity, the tempo and the relentlessness of it, because it just never let up, it's a theory that probably is given sort of some kind of veracity by that, simply because, you know, well, it was a really difficult game, especially on older guys like, you know, looking at the guys that who had to go for HIAs, particularly on older guys like Dwayne Van Meulen, who's 37, Peter Steph Tutoi is probably, you know, around 30 or whatever it is, but like he's played for so long and he's had so many injuries. Yeah. And then obviously Bongi Mbonambi, who's another one, you know, sort of early 30s. So the implication and or accusation is that we are now, what we're doing is, because obviously you can call your own HIA as opposed to sort of being forced by the medic at the ground, that talk is becoming that, hang on, wait, are these guys sort of, you know, using it to catch a quick breather? I don't know how long an HIA is supposed to take, but you can take me through the protocols of it. What's your thoughts? Because it's kind of like a low key accusation, but it's actually a big accusation if you really look at it.
It is on both fronts. But in speaking to one of the domestic coaches yesterday, they explained that the HIA protocol is 12 minutes, the blood replacement is 12 minutes, and it is indeed called by the particular team's doctor on consultation with the game's chief medical officer. The thing is, rugby at the moment is facing a very significant, actually for lack of a better word, headache with regards to post-career head issues. So the last thing now, I think the world rugby wants to worry about is a player showing or having a head knock, and for them saying that, no, that head knock is not good enough for you to be on the field. So they've left it to the teams to make a decision. One would think that, I mean, I remember Bloodgate, I think it was Harlequins, it was Dean Richards at the time,
yeah,
where they made that very clear. I mean, look, I mean, that one was very blatant. I mean, with that wink from that particular player, that was very blatant. But in this particular game, one could clearly see that they were head knocks. And clearly now, with the direction that World Rugby is taking in terms of dealing with head knocks, I mean, I did sit in the press conference, I think it was a week and a half ago, where they're looking to introduce smart gum guards to measure the amount of impact that the head is taking in a particular tackle and in a particular collision, and with the data from that particular collision informing whether a player should stay on the field after head knock or should be invalidated from that game and subsequent engagements with this thing, with matches. So there is the England rugby would be in well within their rights to especially with the game of this magnitude that's coming this particular weekend, to really think that maybe the Fox are trying to use rolling subs. But at the end of the day, and as Rafi said and as Jacques said, on both occasions, Jacques after the press conference on Sunday, Rafi said saying that they always need to put the safety of the player first. I mean, whenever there's some semblance of a head knock, there's always a medical practitioner who tries to run the field. I mean, when you look at Peter Steph to Toy's collision in particular, it was a pity that it happened on the far side of the field, and then play was moving towards the near side of the field, and that prevented Jerome Mampane from actually being able to run across and actually attend to Peter Steph Tutoi. He was only really able to attend him when he actually got up and moved towards where play was taking place, and fortunately was saved by a break in play at that particular moment. So it could be looked at in two ways, but with one understanding that World Rugby is also having to deal with a class action lawsuit with more than 300 rugby players taking them to court for post-career head trauma. World Rugby are in a position where they need to let teams make the decision. But also, on the other hand, if England rugby feels that the process is open to abuse, there needs a middle ground that needs to be found in terms of how the process is then properly managed.
Look, I probably need to correct my language. When I said England, we're coming from England, I probably mean the media as opposed to, you know, the English team itself. So I mean,
yeah,
I suspect if the English team themselves kind of think, you know, there's something is afoot, they might actually just decide, you know what, you know, it's something we'll raise. I guess the real reason we're having to contend with this is I want to say our history since Rassie and them joined, but it's really Rassie's history, isn't it, where people are kind of like, you know, he's you know, he has a history of basically being able to use every available sort of loophole to him to, you know, to gain an advantage for his team in terms of in a place where obviously, you know, the gains are marginal, but if you can get that right, it kind of works. I mean, I'll take you through the list. The 6-2 split, the 7-1 split, you know, being the water carrier, you know, using Twitter to sort of get your points across. You know, I mean, you know, the you know, there's a previous there, and maybe that's what all this reporting is a, how do I put it, is a reaction to.
Yeah. Look, I mean, at the end of the day, coaches need to not just coach what happens on the field, or rugby, if they, the direct directors of rugby, shouldn't be just looking at the entire aspect of the on-field component, but looking at how the roles work for them. I mean, we grew up in an era where New Zealand were often congratulated operating on the fringes of the law, on the field and off the field. But then when it's done by a different team, that team now is accused of being criminal. I mean, at times now, teams who were able to adapt to the smarts that the Bucks bring on the field, they are now being lauded. they've generally been lauded as being smart. Then when the Bucks find a counter to that, then the Bucks are suddenly criticized, not even though even if something that is either pioneering or just the use of an explicit use of the laws, like Damian Williams' 37th minute mark. I mean, it comes across as very revolutionary, whereas sometimes it's just an appreciation of the laws. I actually went back and listened to the commentary at the time of the mark. Justin Marshall was very incredulous with that particular mark that Damian Williams took. But Matt Pierce was quick to remind him that, look, that's within the net, that's within the rules of the game. Damian is allowed to do that. If you don't take a mark, your free kick within the minute of calling mark, you are then awarded a scrum. From where then Rassi explained that, look, we needed to slow the game down. France weren't wanting to scrum, and we just needed to just get a scrum in place. And interestingly, the people who got to that scrum lost were France's two props, Willy Antonio and Cyril Bice. And from there, the Bucks got a penalty advantage. So clearly, this is something that they noticed quickly during the game that France weren't winning scrum. Now, teams may look at that and realize that, look, this is now revolutionary. You mentioned 6-2, for example. France generally go with a 60 split, regardless of who they play. I mean, I went through a list of the team, especially in the past two Six Nations test matches, in those 10 games. France were very impartial to a 6-2 split, and that actually benefits them and their forwards. So that became a trend. I mean, even the All Blacks, when they played the Springboks at Twickenham, I mean, the All Blacks have been very resistant fighting their 6-2 split. But when the box came up with 7-1, New Zealand then went 6-2. So what became out of convention has now become a convention. I mean, France have showed the way. I mean, then box went back to convention going with the 5-3 split that fortunately for them came up. So sometimes what comes across as thinking for others may be revolutionary to some, and anti-revolution to others. But the box do have a director of rugby who literally goes through the rule book and looks at what particular rule will apply for them in a specific instance. When people then complain about this being against the spirit of the game, to quote an issue that is afflicting cricket, if the rule book allows you to do so, then the issues for world rugby to deal with are not the box themselves.
Yeah, I guess that's probably the other way to look at it, which is, the box are kind of like at the front of the queue in terms of coming up with different ways of doing this rugby thing. And I guess, obviously as defending champions, they don't exactly have a choice but to be the ones who are out there and basically sort of paving the way, as it were. I mean, you talk about the France game. I had a nice chuckle when I saw that they also did a move, like we did in the World Cup in 2019, where like it was open play and they basically just formed a mall. I was like, oh, I remember where I saw that from. So yeah, the rest of the field.
And did you see how Eben was able to counter the move? He literally just swam through the rock. They swam through the mall and then got hold of Antoine Tupor. The box got a turnover.
Yeah, I think it's actually the thing that many people who so the box kind of like have a reputation in international rugby where they're basically seen as the boorish sort of and by boorish I meant BOO, if you know what I mean, in terms of the pronunciation. Yeah. They're seen as that, the big bullies of the game. And there's always sort of like been this weird sort of, these guys are stupid as well. One thing a lot of the free world do not want to actually admit watching the box, this current crop of box, is not only are they sort of hyper physical, but they're also clean. If you look at their penalty record or, their disciplinary record, and actually they're a very smart team, as in they very much up to date with the laws of the game. It's something that, it goes missing in the wash because people just want to, focus on the fact that, our team talks, tend to talk about effing them up physically, but actually we are kind of like mentaling our way around it as well.
Yeah. I think the one team that is always talking about this and felt that they're not listened to are the All Blacks. When their conversations come up about playing with the Fox, they will talk about the physicality, but it will also be at pains to express that the box will give you far more physicality, but will also try hide their smarts from you. I think I mean, the Twickenham game, for example, you actually highlighted this even before the podcast, under that what the Box did was not to just send out a physical message, but how they think about the game and how they outthink and try out analyze the opposition. And I think it's generally a Northern Hemisphere thinking, except for Ireland. I think Ireland in particular will know that playing the South African team in the URC, they are far more exposed to a different way of South African rugby thinking, especially when they play the Stormers and when they play the Sharks. Yeah. So they were fully aware of of the particular rugby smart that South Africa bring. I think when you come to countries like France, maybe let's just say to Wales, or understandably so, will feel the physical pressure first. Along with Scotland, they'll always think along those lines that we'll get bullied here. The teams who play regularly against South African teams, New Zealand will know this in particular, even Australia, that there's a fair bit of thought behind South African rugby. And I think England, it's going to be interesting to see how this weekend's game in particular pans out.
And Trucks, I mean, just to obviously move on now, you know, you talk about physicality and smart. The semi-final is a few days away, but obviously the next sort of big milestone in terms of how we sort of, you know, measure our rugby week, if I should call it that, is that we've got, you know, we've obviously got the team announcement coming up. If I'm not mistaken, in our chats, you said it's going to be on Thursday. I mean, it's been yep. an absolute event, you know, since the tournament started, you know, because you haven't quite known what you're going to get. Even in that 5-3 split, I think I wrote a story kind of, you know, as a reaction to the 5-3 split that, you know, these guys built us up. Russ, he was talking about an 8-0, 7-1, 4-4 split. And you're sitting there and you're like, no, man, these guys couldn't be that crazy or, you know, reckless almost. We get a 5-3 split and you sit there and you're like, oh, in the end, the actual surprise was the fact that there was no surprise. How are we looking? Obviously, this is looking back at the fact that we played the last quarterfinal, which basically means the least recovery time before Saturday's game against England. How are we looking? Are we in a situation where, because we've rotated so much, we could make significant changes to the team that plays against England? Of course, there's also the small matter of, you know, people are underestimating England. You know, pretty much like people underestimated us when we were playing England in Japan in the final. But, you know, is there scope for change? Because maybe guys kind of like redlined a little too much in that game against France, because not only was it full pace, it was, you know, it was up tempo, physical, and just relentless. Is there a chance we might see sort of significant changes?
I don't think so in particular. I suspect there could be one or two personnel changes. I wouldn't be surprised if a Trevor Nyakane returns on the bench just to soften up an England pack towards the end. I think the Box know pretty well that, excuse me, that if there's one thing that England don't mind doing, it's scrumming. But also, their scrum was patently saved by Matthew Reynolds' whistle against the Fiji. There was particular scrums. I think there was one I saw just before halftime where Fiji scrum so well, they held the ball at the back then, instead of actually giving a penalty, Matthew Reynolds to play the ball. And I was pretty much bemused. I was like, England have been just scrummed off into the old port, and yet you're able to not actually give a penalty. So I think that the Box will make a tackle change and bring in probably keep Ox and Trevor waiting for that second half push, because I mean the Box coming the second half has probably been a saving grace. But I think when you look at the number of minutes the Box have actually got through, they've been able to rotate the squad very well. I think the only two players who had more than 200 minutes were Damien Willems and Jesse Creel, and those are both backline players. So I think they may have taken quite a physical toll from that particular game, but I think what they've done is to manage and to rest players very well. So there may be changes slightly here and there, but I don't think that there would be significant changes, because ideally the Box also want to pick the strongest team for this particular game. And knowing full well that post that meeting, they've been able to manhandle England. I mean, even when they've lost, they lost those games at Twickenham, they were able to deal with England physically, even though the biggest issue with the Box in those games was their ability to finish opportunities in the 22. What they did so well on Sunday was to get in the 22 and score. I mean, they had 90 cumulative just over, I think, 2 minutes in the 22 in the first half on Sunday, yet they scored 19 points. If the Bucks are able to marry that precision in execution along with the physical dominance, I'm not going to say they're going to have an easy game, but they should have the better of England. But on the other hand, England have been able to build a significant hit of momentum. Yes, they came into the tournament as probably the weakest of the Celtic nations, of the Isles nations, but they are the ones as former world champions who are still in the tournament. All the teams ranked above them going into the World Cup in the Northern Hemisphere are now out. So clearly, England have done well. What England have done very well is that whenever they've got an opportunity to get points, they've got points. If you look back at the particular Argentina game that they won, it effectively changed their fortunes. That was the opening game against Marseille. When England had a chance to get points, whether it was a drop goal, whether it was a penalty, they took those points. So I think what becomes key for South Africa is to maintain their ability not to concede penalties. You mentioned that they've been keeping on the clean side of the game. They only conceded 6 penalties. And a lot of those penalties weren't even in the vicinity of the 22. That's probably the one thing that kind of knocked them against Ireland, but they've got better at it as the tournament progresses. So if the Bucks are able to keep their game relatively error-free like they did on Sunday, stands the physical beating that they took, there should be a decent space. But the one thing that Rati said in yesterday's press conference was that they are not under any circumstances underestimating England. And he made a point of saying that when you look at the team in the semifinals, England are the only unbeaten team. That should say something. Don't look at the opposition. Look at the fact that they're the only unbeaten team in the semifinals. That is a very good head of momentum to build, regardless of who you play, because at the end of the day, you don't pick the draw, you get put in a draw, and you need to sort your way out in the semifinals.
All right, I'm gonna come back to the team selection thing, but I'm seeing that you've picked up a head of steam about the English side. I read a piece that that was written off Rossi's press conference, and you know, this is basically him making the comparisons between England and the Springboks at this tournament. He says they've scored 19 tries and 180 points, and we've scored 26 and also have 180 points. And then they've conceded 63, we've conceded 62. And essentially what he's kind of saying is that actually there's more to the two teams than meets the eye. Obviously, you can go back and say they weren't exactly in the group of death, and they didn't have a quarterfinal against the hosts, a very good host team, which under any other circumstances probably would have gone through that game. Obviously, it's this is a team we really kind of like should still be afraid of, because the one thing I've always looked at England for is, you know, for all the talk under Eddie Jones about, you know, making, you know, playing all this interesting rugby, England's basic DNA is not too dissimilar to South Africa's. You know, they invest in a big pack of forwards, a fly half who can kick, a very good rugby defense. And of course, the other thing they've not done is they've invested in poaching our old bloody conditioning trainer, Alet Walters. So not exactly a team to take lightly.
Indeed. And I think where England did so well in their games was to just outlast the opposition. They had no right winning that game against Samoa, but they outlast Samoa. Even in the Argentina game, they were, for the better part of the game, the second best team, but they were better disciplined, they were better conditioned, and whenever they got into a position to score points, they did. And that is essentially what Rusty is saying in not so many words, and that if you give England an opportunity to score points, they will take them. They're not quite worried about how they play. Theirs is just, they need to get into the business end of the tournament, because there was nothing flash about how they played against this thing, against Ireland, against Argentina. They played rugby in the right side of the field, got points. They did the same thing against Samoa, played the rugby, even in that game, the officiating left a lot to be desired. The results will record that England have won. And I think again, in the Fiji game, yes, in that first half, they converted points. And that's probably that buffer was the one that allowed them to see Fiji off in the second half, because Fiji also missed 6 points off the tee that would have made a big difference towards the end of the game, even though, again, the officiating was a different story. But the DNA is very similar. And I think what often the box have not always struggled is a team that tends to play like them, where France did have the traits of South Africa's DNA, but with a lesser physicality, with a lesser sustained physicality, which is why the box were able to just take the game, take what should have been what France looked at as an 8-round fight. The box took it to 12, and that's why the box won. If they carry the thing with this England side, even in the Twickenham game last year, they were able to go for the better part of the game for at least 11 rounds before the box just had that extra in the tank to take the game deeper. So I think the key now for South Africa is to just make sure that they just take the game deep. I think England will, especially with Joe Marler, I think the respect he deserves as a scrummager, even though England did struggle in the scrums against Fiji, they did struggle even against Samoa. They didn't have the best of time at scrum time. They do have a side that, when switched on, when determined, will give any team in the world problems. And I think what they've done was to develop themselves under the radar. But I think now they're in the spotlight against a team that they've been very competitive against over the past 7 years.
Last question, and we're going to jump back to the selection, actually. Weird question to ask about the box, especially given the game this guy's had. With a Lucanio present, and by all accounts training well, do you take a chance on playing him instead of Jesse Creel, who obviously, like, you know, literally spilled blood and guts all over, you know, the Paris turf in what was, for me, his best performance in a Bok jersey? Do you start making sort of left field calls like that, and obviously maybe a 6-2 split, you know, going back to a 6-2 split, or do you just leave well alone?
Look, I think actually the one player who may need to be significantly worried about a change in the team would be Willy Leroux, because in the times that he's come on, yes, in the 2019 World Cup, he wasn't in the best of form, but he made crucial interventions here and there. He hasn't looked distinctly off colour in the tournament. And I think he's been offset by the fact that Damian Willemse has been pretty much a gold standard for the box at fullback, to a point where Willy hasn't been missed. If the box are looking to make changes, in the back, most probably Lucanio in the 23, but actually off the bench, away from where they can actually make changes within the back line. In the event of a 6-2 split, a left field call would be to move, if they're looking to substitute a back, Marnie moving to fullback may not be such a bad idea, but whether they've actually practiced with him at fullback, it does remain to be seen. But I think the player who has probably the most to do, because I think Jesse Creel, as you rightly said, I think, and I'm also in agreement, I actually said this during the game, that I've never seen Jesse Creel play so well. And also, he played so smartly, because the thing, Jesse Creel has always been judged on his physicality and his physique and his athletic gifts. He actually played a very smart game of rugby. And I mean, Gael Sik was probably a player who 9 out of 10 would have thought that he would have outsmarted Jesse Creel. Everywhere, look, Jesse Creel was in front of him, always read his lines, always read whatever he tried to do. So I think dropping Jesse Creel now may not be such a great idea considering how he played. So I think if the box stick to 5-3, needing to include Lucanio, one would feel that Willy Leroux could be the one to lose out. But also the box will want to actually make sure that they keep the physicality touch on. So in a 6-2 split, it's going to be an interesting call. I mean, as you rightly said, figuring out what the box will look like on a match day now has become proper rugby Russian roulette.
All right, Trucks, that I think we should leave it at that, because there's still an awful lot to unpack with the rest of the week to unfold. Well, as far as we're concerned, you can always, you know where to catch us and you know what time to catch us. I'm not 100% sure if it'll still be me tomorrow, but who knows?